I'm Chris Mandel, director of the Sedgwick Institute. Welcome to this installment of Sedgwick Institute Live, where I profile influential thought leaders who make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Chris Brigham, president of Brigham Associates and a recognized thought leader in human potential, disability, and ability. We'll talk more about what that means here in a minute, but let me give you a little background on Chris. He specializes in the application of evidence-based medicine and best practices to promote human function. He's the author of a book, Living Abled and Healthy, Your Guide to Injury and Illness Recovery. You can see more about that at www.livingabled.com. He's editor-in-chief of the American Medical Association Guides, Newsletter, and Casebook, senior contributing editor for the AMA Guides to the Evaluation of Permanent Impairment. He's written over 250 peer-reviewed articles, chaired the Medical Advisory Board for the Medical Disability Advisor. He has a medical degree from Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis, a Master's of Medical Science from Rutgers Medical School, is board certified in occupational medicine, a fellow of the American College of Occupational Environmental Medicine, and a fellow of the International Academy of Independent Medical Evaluators. He's performed thousands of independent medical evaluations throughout his career, and he's also founding director of the Faith-Based Claims Association. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. It's really wonderful to be here with you today. I appreciate your kindness inviting me.
My pleasure, and thank you for your time and sharing some of your expertise and thoughts with us. So, Chris, I always like to start with the personal, so my audience can better know who my subjects are. So tell me about yourself, your family, and how you spend your free time.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Chris. It's really wonderful that you first ask about our lives, rather than just what we do work-wise, which is so often our focus. And, you know, for me and maybe others too, you know, life balance can be a challenge. Personally, I'm married. My wife, Kathy, and I live on the East Coast now, the summer and fall in Maine, the rest of the year in South Carolina, where I am today. Previously, we were in Hawaii, but it was much closer to be here with family. I do miss Hawaii, but we have three grown daughters, and we have four grandchildren. In terms of other aspects of my life, I try to keep my life reasonably balanced, focusing on my health in terms of the body, mind, and spirit. We'll talk about that further. My faith is important to me. I'm a Christian, a Stevens minister. I've worked closely with the Marine Corps Wounded Warriors Battalion. And in terms of my free time, which I really cherish, I love to travel, both national and international. I just returned from spending the 3 weeks in Peru, much of it with shamans in the rainforest, which was an incredible difference in experiences versus our healthcare system here. I do cycling 100 to 300 miles a week. I kayak, I sail, and I play tennis. Not well, but with joy.
Oh, my goodness. So you're like, what, 32 or something? Or?
I times two, plus a little bit.
Well,
I feel
that's
like
pretty
32.
Impressive. 100 to 300 miles a week, that's impressive. Let me probe on one thing that maybe people don't know much about, and I remember this, but I only know so much. Tell me about what a Stevens minister is.
A Stevens minister does one-on-one ministry work with those who are in need. And actually what I did is I applied those skills to my work with the Wounded Warriors at the Marine Corps base in Kaneohe, Hawaii, and developed some really remarkable relationships of awesome Wounded Warriors.
Very good. That's a great great thing you're doing. It really is. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, now let's turn to your career a little bit and talk about what you're doing and what you've done. So let's start with a brief overview of your career, just the highest level detail.
Sure. And Chris, you've already touched upon aspects of it. My career has been like far more complex and convoluted than I may have ever envisioned as a youth. I started my background in computer sciences. My first computer was in a barn with vacuum tubes. And some of our listeners may not be familiar with the concept of vacuum tubes. But I ended up doing consulting at the medical school at Rutgers, was a teaching assistant there, decided to go into medicine, went to Washington University, did residency training in family practice and clinical medicine. However, I realized that I could have more impact on healthcare systems in a different role than being a direct provider of healthcare. So I went back, I did training in occupational medicine, got my boards in preventive medicine, have directed various programs over the years, really focusing on trying to understand why people with the same injury and illness have different outcomes, how do we fairly evaluate that and manage that. And have developed a variety of resources. You know, I have an interest in being an entrepreneur, that is, you know, looking at new opportunities and how do we really develop resources that will be helpful. And then my recent focus has been on the issue of living abled and how do we create change that permits all of us to experience joyful and productive lives.
Well, that's a great segue then, because you authored this book that I mentioned earlier, Living Abled and Healthy, Your Guide to Injury and Illness Recovery, back in 2015. Tell me about the book and why you wrote it.
Sure. The reason I wrote the book is I recognized over the years, I think as many of us do, that often people are needlessly disabled, that they're deprived from the experience of a joyful and productive life. And they're taken away from the situation of being able to work. And work itself is inherently healthy. So if we look at the whole issue of disabling, beyond the workers' compensation area, if we look at other disability systems, you know, the entitlement systems, insurance systems, we realize that there are many people there who get into those systems who really don't have to be there. And that, you know, so I started looking at that, and I started working on a book, Chris, called The Crippling of America. It was going to be an expose about these issues. But then you realize that many of the stakeholders do certain actions because of the design of the system, and they probably will not want the systems to change because they make more money as the systems are designed right now. We can talk about that in healthcare providers, attorneys, and the like. But I realized there was a big there was a gap, that and the gap was that we didn't have an effective resource to educate, engage, and empower all of us who may be dealing with injury or illness about how do we move forward, how do we really understand aspects of our health, how do we relate to the healthcare systems, to the challenges we face, how do we relate to other providers. And so decided to shift from the book on the crippling of America to Living Abled. And in doing this, you know, I've written a number of professional books, but it's quite different, you know, writing for a medical audience versus all of us. So it needed to be interesting, you know, it needed to be understood at a variety of levels. Therefore, I involved a very skillful co-author, Henry Bennett. And after, I mean, it was really years of writing, really 2 years of intense involvement that Living Abled became a reality, both in terms of the book and the website.
So it sounds like you went from a no aspersions cast, but a negative approach to a more positive approach. You know, how can we live a more effective, abundant life, right?
Exactly, and I think that's one of the things we deal with in the workers' compensation system. We often focus on the negative, you know, the pain, what people can't do. You know, we focus on workers' compensation as opposed to workers' recovery. And so, you know, maybe I really need to be focusing this in a different way and have it more positive.
Mm-hmm. So in the book, you talk about a concept known as biopsychosocial as an approach to injury, disease, and disability. Can you explain that for me?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Chris. When we use the term biopsychosocial, it refers to bio, the biology, the physical, psych, the mind, and social, the social context. So whenever we're dealing with health, we need to deal with health in terms of the body, the mind, and the spirit. Now, so often we focus only on the physical. And however, you know, the reality is that the more important determinant about what someone does with their lives is not the physical, it's the mind and the spirit. And, we sort of get afraid of that from a claims perspective because we just want to deal with, you know, the physical issues. We don't want to open a psych thing. So we sometimes just sort of cast that away rather than look at how do we honor and how do we recognize these other issues and how can we help people with like a core issue of resiliency through our caring process. How do we deal with the social perspective, you know, particularly litigation, which is very much a driver of chronic pain and poor outcomes. So biopsychosocial is looking at health from a much broader concept, you know, one that really encompasses who we are and is something that we can really modify.
Mm-hmm. So resiliency, that's an interesting word. It gets used a lot in the business continuity world. It's actually making its way into the risk management world that I've been a part of for most of my career. We at Sedgwick are talking about how we really need to prioritize through care. The concept of caring counts as caring as a priority for not what we no longer say as our claimants, but are really more customers and consumers. So we really understand what you're saying, and really I don't know how well or quickly we're going to be able to bridge that gap between just dealing with the facts of the things that we can actually understand well and the things that affect injury. So I think about, for example, the massive impact of opioid abuse, which the Institute is spending a bit of time on. We're doing some research on. And I wonder what you think about that as it relates to what you were just talking about.
Well, actually, there are a number of things that you share that sort of that touched me is that, and let me go through those and we can explore that discussion, is resiliency is really a key issue. And if we look at, you know, if I look at somebody who I characterize people who are, let's say, needlessly disabled versus who are exceptional, they're inspirational, they may have a significant injury, and they go on and they may be a different person than who they were before, but they're vibrant, they're involved, they're typically working. And there are many characteristics of contrasting those two groups, but one of the key things is resiliency. How do we deal with life's challenges? How do we move forward? And there are different ways of resiliency styles. One of the best insights to this is some of the work of Rob Auerbach, who at uncommonapproach.com. Rob is well-known internationally in the workers' compensation area, has looked at that and actually developed some tools to characterize the different aspects of resiliency. But you know, and people, so the issue is that, you know, resiliency we learn early in life, you know. So what do we do later in life if we have somebody who's not as resilient? It's actually been shown that one of the best ways to help someone who lacks resiliency is caring and to establish a relationship with them. So when you talk, Chris, about that your focus now is on caring, you know, that, you know, and caring counts, that reinforces what we're learning, that that's what we need to be doing. That's going to reinforce resiliency. That's going to help. It's going to help people. And it's also, you know, recognizing what you're doing with looking at Sedgwick is looking at best practices. You know, what works and what doesn't work. I think one of the challenges we face is when we did this, you know, grand bargain of workers' compensation 100 years ago, we never envisioned how complex the system would be. You know, and how incredibly, you know, complex and very commercial, all these vendors and all these this chaos has occurred, and also that the design of the system would drive certain behaviors. So when you talk about opioids, with healthcare providers, we pay physicians to do things. We don't pay them for outcomes. So we have many fine providers, but we've got some bad providers and who are doing things that either from ignorance or from greed that are egregious. And so the opioids are a classic example. Yes, it develops a dependent patient who will come back to your practice over and over again. You make money from doing that. You may even make more money if you're going to office dispense these drugs. And it's egregious. It destroys lives. So we have, you know, confronting that is excellent. I think the other issue is that we have a heavy influence of big pharma. And we, in a society, we look, you know, we have a health problem, we look at what drug do we take to resolve it. We don't look at some of the core issues of lifestyle modification and other facts, you know, that we've been proven to be facts that are often much more beneficial than taking a drug. So when you say that Cedric is responding in this way, I applaud you, because that's the direction we need to go.
Well, thank you. Not that we don't have a lot of time to dwell on the opioid issue, but I'm very interested in just one, your one idea that might impact that problem. Because what I've discovered as I've done the due diligence on it for the Institute is that it's just massive. Approaching a pandemic, I guess, in some respects, that's probably overstating it. But, I mean, it is pervasive at a minimum. And you know, as well as maybe better than others, that what effect it has on the recovery process when the sole focus is on how to get the next high to feed an addiction. So what do you think is maybe just one significant idea, going back to the idea of building resiliency in people that aren't resilient, because I think maybe addicts aren't resilient, might help solve this problem or at least contribute to its solution?
I think it's applying evidence-based medicine. You know, when we look at any intervention, we look at what is the risk versus the benefit of the intervention. And there is a role for narcotics in patients, for example, who have, you know, a cancer, malignancy, some type of, you know, terminal process. There may be some role in some patients who functionally improve with narcotics, but it's rare. And so that the overall, you know, the benefit is not there. We also have issues with the patients becoming, you know, more sensitive to pain when they're on narcotics. And that's, even I think a lot of physicians aren't aware of that, is that, you know, when you wean somebody off narcotics, often their pain actually decreases, and paradoxically. So we have something that really doesn't work. We have something that has resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of individuals. And then we have manufacturers who have literally made billions of dollars on this. And I think what we need to do is say no, and just to be very firm with it. So I think in terms of looking at best practices is, I would say, you know, severely limiting the ability for physicians to dispense narcotics, and then to take actions very strongly against physicians who are doing this. It's interesting, in other areas of healthcare, if a physician did something that's really bad, they would be held responsible for that. They would face potential medical malpractice. That doesn't happen in workers' compensation. I would love to see that, you know, making the physicians more responsible for the consequences of their actions when they do things that are inappropriate, particularly when they do it from the standpoint because it's greed, because it's money. We should have zero tolerance for that.
Yeah, so as culpable as the patient is in this particular problem, you know, the doctor really is the wizard behind the curtain pulling the levers of control. Or lack of control over it. So,
well, it's the doctors, but you know, it's also the other participants. So we have a system that we know that litigation makes it the outcome of a case much more challenging and a poorer outcome. So when we, you know, if we have a unnecessary involvement of attorneys in litigation, or we have an attorney who is not doing what is, from my perspective, what the best practice, best benefit of their client, and refers them to a doctor because the doctor then is going to do things that will probably increase the value of the claim because they're going to have lousy outcomes, and that doctor may prescribe opioids. That attorney making that referral to that bad doctor should also be, you know, culpable for it. So it's really complex.
Yeah, there's a lot of stakeholders, and you're right, attorneys are at the heart of it in so many cases. Well, let's go a little more broad on this idea. What do you believe is the biggest impediment to getting injured workers, for example, or those affected by disease more engaged in their treatment and recovery?
Well, you know, first of all, the engagement, it needs to occur from day one. Yeah, it's got to include empowerment. It's got to include education. I think as we before we look at the impediments, we need to recognize that all the stakeholders need to have an understanding of the broader picture rather than they're just their narrow job. And that, you know, so it, because we have like classically, you know, adjusters have focused on adjusting claims rather than engaging claimants. We have to understand, you know, what the healthcare providers, what their incentives are, the influence of big pharma attorneys and the like. I think that the biggest impediment is that either fear of change, that we get comfortable with how we have been doing things, even when the things are don't make any sense. I think that also the major impediment is that the design of our system drives certain behaviors that if we change that, certain stakeholders are going to potentially make less money, and therefore they don't want to make those changes.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Good thoughts on all of that. Next thing I want to talk about is go back to your book a little bit. What are some of the concepts in your book that are being received well by the stakeholder world that we're talking to, particularly in this broader world of injury, disease, and disability?
Well, I think some of the concepts that have been positively received are understanding the breadth of what health means, understanding the systems in which we function, the being able to navigate through the system. You know, in other arenas outside of workers' compensation and healthcare, often you'll have like the healthcare navigators that help navigate people through the system. We typically don't have that in the workers' compensation system. So I find the feedback has been from people find it just very helpful about how to apply the insights to their situation. And that's, you know, I've been gratified to see that, you know, the ratings on Amazon are 5 out of 5, which I never expected to happen. I think that, you know, what I find is that, you know, there are, you know, some of the concepts are threatening to individuals because if we empower people to make better decisions, that may not benefit certain other stakeholders who've financially gained from bad decisions. It's interesting, Chris, too, that, you know, I had this vision that enlightened employers and claims professionals and healthcare providers would share the book with claimants and integrating that with the educational activities. We're still waiting for that to happen. And I find it difficult to understand that we look at the average, you know, cost of a lost time claim, depending upon, you know, jurisdiction, it's a healthy 5 figures. But often you then say, intervention, that's a small fraction of a physician visit or a prescription. We don't do it. It just doesn't make sense to me. But overall, that the positive response to the concepts, I'd just like to see it integrated more consistently into what we do.
Well, I have some thoughts about that, and we'll take them offline after we're done here. So with a few minutes left, let me just cover a couple other things I wanted to make sure I touched on. You know, we're in the claim business, obviously, at Sedgwick, and I'm wondering how you see the claim professional's role in achieving the outcomes and results that your book endorses and articulates.
Okay. Well, first, Chris, as I mentioned, we all need to understand the larger issues. You know, the topics we expressed that I've explored in Living Abled, for example, the relationship between health and work. And, work is healthy. You know, taking somebody out of work is adverse to their health. And so we should be very discerning about that. We need to understand, how we take care of our health, the connections between our mind and body, and concepts such as neuroplasticity and resiliency, the importance of the terms and the words we use, which are very powerful. How do we effectively use healthcare systems? What are the roles of other providers? I think what the claims professional's role should be with that understanding is they should be advocates for the restoration of health and recovery of function with the appropriate provision of services, that they should be proactive navigators as opposed to claims adjusters.
Mm-hmm. Well put. And I think I can honestly tell you that's where we are migrating our own claim professionals to. In various ways. And so as we support the concept of caring counts, training and education and getting them to do things differently is at the heart of that.
Critically important. It's a challenge, as you know, but it's critically important.
Yep. So what do you think the appropriate linkage is between the work comp world and the broader world of employee health and welfare?
Well, I think there are a number of linkages. Just because, particularly with many of the conditions that we now see coming into workers' compensation, it's really gray whether they should be in the workers' compensation or the general health arena. So it's sort of this gray area that just sometimes just results in poorer outcomes. I mean, we have to see a closer linkage for that. You know, the principles of health and healing and recovery are the same. You know, they're not different there. In both areas, we need to be focusing on prevention, primary, secondary, tertiary. We need to focus on having quality providers involved and with applying evidence-based medicine, the current science to the specifics of a patient, and have much more emphasis on lifestyle medicine, which what reflects is, our choices, our diet, our exercise, our habits.
Very good. Well, we just had an election, which everybody's very focused on, and as I speak, I believe the Congress is already moving quickly to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And so I wonder what your thoughts are about the future of the federal involvement in health care and whether that'll help or hurt the mission that you're on.
Well, Chris, thank you for a impossible question. But I think clearly the future of ACA is threatened, and I understand the concerns about the ACA. I also see that there to have a system that people could access care that who could otherwise not have access care was important. Also, dealing with family with pre-existing conditions, we have to deal with the issue of how do we provide care with people with existing conditions. So, I have some concerns, and my hope and prayers is that it's replaced by something that will give access to health care to individuals that would otherwise not gain access to it. Mm-hmm. Because I think if they don't gain access to it, we're going to see some shifting into workers' compensation. I think mm-hmm. in terms of the federal involvement in health care, that hopefully this would help our mission of having people achieve healthier lives, and that is by more accountability, more focus on what works, what doesn't work, maybe more scrutiny to what has been financially beneficial to certain stakeholders at the expense of patients, that there will be a fresh look at that. And I think particularly what I'm seeing nationally is a more of an understanding that to disable someone is a disservice, that there are some people who will not, or particularly in the society when there's a shortage of jobs, may not be able to return to work. But to have people removed from work really increases their risk of health. And so I see the more emphasis on a federal level of looking at the various disability programs to change what we've done before and have a different understanding of what disability is.
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's any one thing I know about Trump, he's a guy about accountability. So we'll see how that translates into the broader society and the societal realm. It won't be easy for sure, but
it's going to be a challenge. Maybe, and I think it's accountability for everyone, all of us. And mm-hmm. I think that's my philosophy. We need to be accountable for our own actions and our own lives and our organizations. So I certainly embrace accountability.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to share about your book or anything for that matter before we close out?
I just appreciate spending some time with you and the listeners. Chris, I certainly welcome the feedback from our listeners on what they learned from reading Living Abled and how together we can assist all in achieving joyful and productive lives.
Very good. Well, thank you, Chris, for your time and insights today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
To my listeners, you can find my and Dr. Richard Victor's speaking and writing schedules as well as other resources at www.sedgwickinstitute.com. Please consider joining the Institute's LinkedIn group titled Sedgwick Institute, where we dialogue daily on issues of importance to stakeholders in the risk and insurance world. Till next time, when we'll have our next installment of SI Live, I'll be then talking to John Roten, who's the Senior Vice President of Compliance Strategy at Sedgwick. In the meantime, I urge you to use your expertise and influence to make a difference whenever and wherever you can to make our industry better. So long.